The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. You can see the discussion is already very lively. For our post-Valentine presentation, Aloud features a discussion titled Between the Sheets, Sex, Literature, and the Future of Erotic Fiction. What is the function of erotic literature in a society in which sex is both a major obsession and a major taboo? Erotic writing confirms an important measure of our interior worlds, and perhaps because of its power and underground popularity, there are so many reactions to it. From ridicule, feigned boredom, uneasy condescension, erotic writing is, after all, a threat to the conventional moral order. Joining us tonight to discuss these issues are three distinguished writers and thinkers whom it is my pleasure to introduce. And the format for tonight will be our participants will be in discussion and they will read some of their work and talk about the subject, and then we will open it up to questions from the audience, and we will have a microphone circulating, and we ask that you wait till it comes to you so that we can all hear the questions. And then afterwards, Walter Mosley and John Retchie will be signing their books in the lobby. Walter Mosley is the author of more than 25 critically acclaimed books, including the best-selling mystery series featuring E.Z. Rollins. Mosley's work has been translated into 21 languages and includes literary fiction, science fiction, political monographs, a young adult novel, and now a sexistential noir novel called Killing Johnny Fry, a steaming but also surprisingly tender story about a middle-aged New York City man, Cordell Carmel, whose calm existence is turned on end when he discovers his longtime girlfriend with another man named Johnny Fry. Walter Mosley is the winner of numerous awards, including an O. Henry Award, a Grammy, and a Pan American Center's Lifetime Achievement Award. This is his first time here tonight. We're delighted to have him. We're welcoming back tonight John Retchie, who is the recipient of two Lifetime Achievement Awards, Penn USA West's 1997 Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Publishing Triangle's William Whitehead Award for Lifetime Achievement. In September 2000, a CD-ROM of his life and works, Memories and Desire, The Worlds of John Retchie, produced through the Annenberg Center at USC, debuted at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles to an overflow crowd. His now classic first novel, City of Night, was named as one of the 25 all-time best gay novels by the Publishing Triangle in New York. Among his many other works are the novels Numbers, The Coming of the Night, Rushes, Bodies and Souls, and The Miraculous Day of Amalia Gomez. He is also the author of three plays, several short stories, and many essays on a wide range of topics, including gay politics and bodybuilding. Marcia Kinder, who will moderate this evening's discussion, is a professor of critical studies in USC's School of Cinematic Arts, where she teaches international film, narrative theory, and new media. In 1997, she founded and has subsequently directed the Labyrinth Project, a USC research initiative on interactive narrative and database documentary, developing new models of digital scholarship and cultural history. She is also a cultural theorist and film scholar and has published many essays and 10 books. Now please join me in welcoming Marcia Kinder, Walter Mosley, and John Retchie. Turn off your cell phones and have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Before we turn to any questions, we're going to have a brief reading by each writer. So we're going to start with Walter Mosley.
Wow. Walter Mosley has the finest book. I have all these things in my bag.
Welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming this evening.
Yeah, hi. I'm going to read a very brief section. of this book. My book has no chapters. First book I wrote with no chapters. You know, I was writing about black male heroes, or maybe you don't know that, but, and so I wrote this book, and there's a guy, he's a kind of a, I don't know, he's kind of like a nerd. He's kind of like out of it. He's a translator. He only like, not like a fancy translator. He's like a translator, like if you made a bottle of vinegar in Spain and you had like a little something to explain it, he would translate the Spanish into English. You know, he's not, and he has a girlfriend, you know, and she lets him visit her on weekends because she works very hard in the fashion industry. And he thinks his life is just fine. And in the beginning of the book, in a kind of a minor sex scene, the scenes kind of escalate throughout the book, he realizes that his life isn't what he thought it was. And he's just gone out on a date. Not a date. He's a black guy. There's this young white woman. I mean, a lot of people know this, like the scenario. He's a black guy. There's a young white woman who has been to Darfur. He doesn't even know where Darfur is. She has taken pictures of dying children in Darfur and wants him to get her in contact with a guy she knows to, you know, to put the pictures up somewhere. And he is very excited because he's hoping that when she leaves, she'll kiss him on the side of the mouth, because when she kisses him, it's like she kisses him like right next to his lips, not really on the lips, but right next to the lips. And that's what he wants. And so he's just come back from a little lunch with her, and she kissed him. I had the key to Joelle's apartment. The doorman knew me by sight. She was across the river meeting with a boutique jeans distributor from Newark. I'd go upstairs, do my business, and then call her cell phone and ask her to guess where I was. That way I could assuage my guilt by letting her know I was still in town. Robert, the day man, wasn't at his post at her building on 91st and Central Park West. I loped down the hallway toward the third bank of elevators and took car number 16 to the 23rd floor. Joelle had inherited this apartment from her grandmother, who'd died 12 years before when Joe was just 20. It was a big place. The entrance area led to a hall that came upon a sunken living room, which had large windows that look out over the park. I loved staying at Joelle's place. I was happy that I hadn't made a move on Lucy. They were so silent that I almost walked in on them. Joe was sitting on the top part of the back of the couch. Her black blouse was pulled up to her armpits above her breasts. Her black pants were almost off, except for the bottom leg, which somehow clung to her left ankle. John Fry wore only a gray silk shirt. He was standing there between her legs, teasing her sex with his erection. She was staring into his eyes, her copper-brown hands gripping his pale white chest and left shoulder. He looked as if he were concentrating on something inside him. Maybe he was holding back. Maybe he was playing with her. They kept at that game for some time. I noticed that he was wearing a condom, a red one. For some reason, that color made me angry. At times, he'd enter her deeply. These were the only moments that she made any sound, a kind of moan that came out as, oh, and now and then, please don't. I wondered, almost idly, if she would tell me later that she tried to stop him, that she told him no. After a while, I turned away because I couldn't seem to think while watching them. Looking down the hall toward the door, I knew that I should go. There was no benefit in confronting them. John Fry was bigger than I was in every way, and I had no weapon with which to hurt him. And after all, Joelle was not my wife. We stayed together often, but it was her apartment. I decided to leave. I walked down the hallway toward the door. I made it through the front door and took the first three steps down the hall when Joe emitted a loud, pain-filled scream. I hurried back down the hall and into the apartment without thinking. It was almost as if I had forgotten what I'd seen before. All I could think was that my girlfriend, my lover, was in pain. When I got back to the vantage point onto the living room, I realized my error. Joe was on her stomach now, on the floor, and John Fry hovered above her, pressing down slowly with his hips. I could see the red shaft pressing deeper and deeper into her rectum. He was whispering into her ear words that I heard only as a rumble. She was nodding vigorously, saying, yes, yes, oh yes, daddy, daddy. I made it to the hall again. Again, there was a shot of ecstasy, but this time I pushed the elevator button and took car number 18 down to the first floor. "Hello, Mr. Carmel," Robert the doorman said as I approached the desk. There was a wary look in his eye. I could tell that he knew about Johnny Fry and Joe. He was her doorman. Every Christmas, she gave him a $200 tip. He wasn't going to burn that bridge. No, sir.
And now, John Ritchie.
I find it more convenient to read from a printout than from the actual book. So that's what I've done. And I'm going to read a very short passage from my latest novel, which is called The Life and Adventures of Lyle Clemens, which is loosely based on Fielding's Tom Jones. Lyle, I'll just explain very briefly. Lyle is an 18-year-old cowboy who has never ridden a horse. At 15, he was initiated expertly into the ways of sex by an older woman, Rose. From her, he learned how to make love to his Mexican sweetheart, Maria. Very handsome and winning, he's recruited by two avaricious televangelists to perform at revivals as the Lord's Cowboy. Now I will read for 5 minutes. The Write a Love Letter to Jesus campaign opened to a full house of howling, screaming, hurting congregants gathered at the Lord's Headquarters Pentecostal Hall in Anaheim on a warm night. On a set that looked like a rectory in a motel stood 24 of God's little angels, swaying and humming to each word of proclaimed revelation. Wiping massive mascara-drenched tears from her cheeks, Sister Sis, her wig piled like a yellow wedding cake on her head, and Brother Bud, looking like a failed gigolo turned mortician, took turns presenting evidence of miraculous intercession accompanied by donations from everywhere. From a little girl, crippled, skipping merrily along now, a few pennies, but her faith will draw millions. From a man blind for 10 years, able to see the light now, a donation for all he has kept hidden from the Lord. From a sinner drowning in alcohol, from a fornicator lost in lust. Write your own love letters to Jesus, and with your heavenly donations, send your heavenly donations, and we shall deliver them. We shall deliver your letter to him by prayer's fastest post, Sister Sis begged. And now, to rouse the living spirit, here is, Brother Bud began his introduction of Lyle. A swell of hallelujahs from God's little angels, a flutter in feathery tissue wings, proclaimed the appearance of the Lord's Cowboy, Sister Sis screamed. Decked in new jeans fitted tightly by the Lord's seamstress, a western shirt sewn with the Lord's threads, an extra button hurriedly opened by Sister Sis, his cowboy hat hurriedly blessed by Brother Bud, and wearing his cherished Tony Lama boots, Lyle walked to the center of the set. He froze. Now what? He strummed a few uncertain, quivery notes on his guitar. Arouse them in the spirit of the Lord, cowboy, Sister Sis pled over jiggles of her tambourine. Do your damn preacher dance, Brother Bud commanded. Go at it, cowboy, Rose encouraged from the past when she had tossed him back on her bed and sent his long legs flying wide apart for her. That was it. Lyle decided he would rely on Sweet Rose's expert instructions. He strummed on his guitar and sang improvised words and then abandoned the words and strummed and strummed and did the preacher strut and hopped back, forward, forward, back, forward, forward, forward. And he thought of sweet Rose, her legs open to welcome him, and of Maria, naked that afternoon, her lips as red as cherries, white flesh peppered by the small, astonishing triangle, sheltering the pink opening, eager nipples begging to be nibbled, lush flesh, scarlet lips, one bare leg crooked over the other, tiny sequiny hairs peeking out, glistening right there, exactly there. And his body responded, just as it had with Maria, just as it had with Rose the very first time, flesh on flesh. And when his excitement became too prominent, he hopped, hopped, plucking his guitar, disguising his arousal, wiggling sideways, forcing it down, but not too much, to gales of approbation, howls of approbation, hallelujah. And the congregation screamed with joy, and some of the afflicted began hopping in the aisles, hallelujah. And the and the panting congregation swayed to the rhythm of the Lord's cowboy, who was sweating so hot, oh Lord, so hot, that his shirt clung to his chest with perspiration where Maria had kissed him and he had kissed her breasts and kissed Rose's and Maria's. Hallelujah, oh yes, naked breasts, white thighs parted. Oh Lordy, yes, cowboy, you learned just right. Now thrust and right on, Rose encouraged from the past. And his erection threatened to bust through his pants, hallelujah, and the congregation went wild and hollered, "Yea, Lord, come to us, come, come, come." And their bodies strained toward the Lord's cowboy, hallelujah, their hands grasping high as he bumped, ground, thrust, pumped, doing the preacher strut like God and the angels intended. Back, back, hop, hop, back, hop, whip around, arch toss and hop, whip around and bump and grind and whip around. And don't you know that the Holy Spirit surged through the Lord's cowboy like electricity, and it oozed out, flooding in bursts into the congregation. And a woman in the audience screamed, "Oh, Lordy, Lordy, Lord," and fainted in the aisle, slain dead in the spirit, while God's little angels trilled breathlessly, "The spirit done groped the cowboy."
Well, I think we've begun with really two marvelous examples of the erotic in literature, which imply that it's alive and well. I wanted to ask some questions tonight that sort of addressed maybe some similarities and differences between you, but also try to address the question of what is the future of erotic literature, particularly in a digital age where there's such an emphasis on very explicit visuals, and where the explicit visuals are so ubiquitous, not only on online and pornographic websites, where even so-called ordinary people are streaming their daily erotic behavior, or not only available on cable television stations, and also in new mobile handheld devices where you can watch erotic material both in public or in private. And one question that seems to occur to me is, does this mean that these rival media, these visual, very explicitly visual media, suggest that erotic literature is tame or quaint? I think tonight's passages indicate they're not, because, you know, there's such marvelous visual material here. Or do they, in fact, do something quite different, which is to clarify what are the distinctive qualities and the unique pleasures of erotic literature? Erotic literature that maybe is interactive, more interactive than a lot of digital media, in enabling the reader to participate, to collaborate on the visualizations, and also to provide a much safer position for the reader, rather than being entrapped into being a villain on reality television, you know, as is frequently occurring. So I wondered if you could talk about this to some degree. In other words, how you see the changing role of erotic literature in this digital age. And does this affect how you visualize it? Either one of you.
I see him do that. He goes, Walter.
Well, I think it's
the Teflon Don there. That was a long question.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit about this backstage because I was a programmer, computer programmer for 15 years. And so I'm not all that impressed by computers I've been watching, as a little kid I talked a lot. I lived in Watts, and I talked so much that at the age of 7 my father bought me a television set. I was the only child. He put it in my room. I was the only kid within 10 miles of my house that had his own television set in 1958. I'm not very impressed by television either. I've seen a lot of it. But, no matter what, it was a tiny TV. But the thing about it, we were talking, there's always been, periods of very explicit sex and periods of repression and all cultures all throughout history. And, the fact that, where you see it, like if you see it on a screen or you see it at the orgy or you see it, written on a wall or printed in a book, what kind of difference the digital age is. Computers do interesting things in certain places. I'm not sure there. But one of the things is that what you can do with literature, you can actually explain deeply how people feel and how they transform through their experiences in the world. One of the reasons that I wanted to write, I'm very uncomfortable with the term erotic literature. I'm more comfortable with pornography, but not that comfortable with it. I wrote a book about sex. It seems like simple. It's like I wrote a book about crime. It's like I really wanted to kind of place this heterosexual male in a world where he was actually feeling having sex. And the sex that he was feeling was changing him on all these other levels. The reasons we get involved in, and what you have in, like, with images of sex, like, here are two people, fucking. Here is somebody tying somebody up and beating them and then fucking them. Here's, you could go on, you can have that, go on forever. But it's all external. It's all surface. And so it's very hard to get deeply into it. And there are very few films and there's very few things on the internet, even things that are really happening to people, which allow you to get into how they feel and who they are and how they're transforming. And so literature always has that going for it. And that's what I think that's why that's different. I worry about erotica because sometimes, people that make gestures towards sex and they don't really talk about sex. They talk about they let you make it up in your head, and I would rather not do that.
John?
John.
Okay.
John.
I don't have any doubt that that the proliferation of pornography, of graphic sex, and now even categorized into specialties, you can punch breasts, and breasts come up, or
left breast.
I
like the left hole.
I have no doubt that it's going to impact literature. But as Walter said, literature will be there to explore. You can't talk about sex without punning, but to explore much more deeply. Yeah. The effect to be able to explore what effect it's going to have not only on literature, but on people, on their sexuality. Right. Is it going to replace, as I believe it is doing now, is it going to replace the actual sex act so that people then become in major part voyeuristic? And acting out fantasies in virtual reality, but not really. You hear about people who now devote their time, their full time to pornography. So I think that the serious writer will as he always has, go and explore much more deeply. I've been writing graphically about sex since back in 1967. City of Night has no graphic sex, though people think it does. But it has none at all. It just is about sex, and that sets people off so much that they think, oh, God, you know, this thing is filthy.
That's great, yeah.
But there's not a single sex act in that book that got banned and tossed around and all kinds of things. But in 67, I did write very graphically about sex. But now I find myself increasingly using sex metaphorically. I'll use what I read as an example, and you know, I condensed this, but I wanted to link it to the hypocrisy of religion. That here is this guy who's, you know, getting very, very aroused, and here are the people responding. To me, and I've written about it more directly. The Christian religion, at any rate, and especially Catholicism, is saturated in erotic images. Since I was raised a Catholic, I remember the enormity of seeing this very hunky Christ on the cross. Yeah, and he's always naked.
Bondage.
Yeah, always
bondage
naked,
on the cross,
always
yeah.
naked, always very beautiful, and you know the thing around his waist as low as it can possibly get, so that you see obliques that only 1,000 sit-ups a day could get you, and then you know the thing dips very low in front of him, as if.
Well, you need it.
Yeah.
You need it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't get shorter.
Full coverage.
That. Yeah. And there he is, posing glamorously, I think. And the association of masochism and eroticism. Well, I think that one can, you know, explore these things. I wrote a book called Rushes, in which I said it one night in a leather bar, and it ends in an orgy room. And I framed it as Stations of the Cross, ending with actual crucifixion. So I think that the writer will move much more deeply into the metaphor of sexuality.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and that those Stations of the Cross we actually dramatized.
That's right, in the CD-ROM that Marcia made of my life.
Right, you know, but it's interesting that you chose a passage that was satirical and humorous, you know, and Walter chose a passage that is pivotal to the book in the sense of that, you know, that primal scene that sort of starts to really initiate that whole sequence of his encountering himself. And you know, and you have the subtitle of your book as Sexistential Novel. Right, a term that would also refers to many of John's work would apply. I mean, particularly Numbers and Rushes, and you know, many other works. And in some ways, I'm wondering, you know, that metaphor in terms of what sexuality means in your experience. If you see that as parallel to the writing as well, in other words, both of you are incredibly prolific. Both of you.
Not as prolific as Joyce Carol Oates.
Okay, but I mean, in the sense of if it's going to be a sexistential novel and it's going to, if sexual experience is really going to redefine you and make you alive and make you discover your inner self, which is something that's true in Numbers as well. Does it have to be really risky sex? Does it have to be really painful sex? Does it have to be masochistic? Does it have to be sadistic? I mean, in other words, what does it entail that pushes it to the line of being sexistential? And is that analogous to your own attitude toward writing, of what writing means for you, too?
I don't understand that last part of that question.
Okay, well, I mean...
I understand everything up to...
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, in the sense that you are both so prolific, and the whole notion of writing, the repetition compulsion, in a sense, for the act of writing itself becomes a way of defining you. Maybe that's wrong for you, Walter. Is that true for you, John?
I think so.
I think it is true for you, you know. But I'm wondering, you know, in the sense of what does it mean to be writing a sexistential novel? Well, we can start there.
For me, I mean, it's true that there's like there's a couple of extended metaphors in the book, in this book, which is the only book I've really kind of written specifically, you know, like about sex, and they have to do with kind of rampant melancholia and a very deep loneliness that very many people. One of the problems that my main character experiences, not only has he lost his girlfriend, but this is his only friend. And he really only sees her on weekends. And he has his life, and his life falls apart. He never takes on his job. He doesn't do his job anymore. He doesn't translate. He just stops. He tries to find a new profession. He finds this thing called the friend line, and you can call it, and there'll somebody, you know, on the phone will be your friend, because, you know, so many people don't have friends, including this guy. And so a lot of the metaphor of the sexuality itself is an emptiness, is a loneliness. And then the other thing, of course, for me, is to deal with love itself, where, you know, his girlfriend says, well, you know, love is common. Everybody feels love. Everybody up and down the street feels love. Everybody, all through history, feels love. Says, you know, this other guy, he gives me what I need, not love. You know, and I get that from almost anybody, and that's what I mean. That's what she thinks, and I think that for me that this is like a way to start talking in my sense politically about and also culturally about what's going on with people, with all kinds of people all over the place, and how we get lost. And an interesting thing, you know, because you know I love The Stranger by Albert Camus, but I always, you know, I didn't feel bad saying it, but I have a criticism of the end. Because the end is kind of part of that question you're asking. Like, there's a kind of an assumption in existentialism that you're going to overcome the problem, when really and truly the problem usually overcomes you. You know, the chance of you, so the chance of you actually overcoming it, like, you know, God, aren't I lucky? I've been sentenced to death, and I can fight for life, but they're going to execute me anyway. So that, in some way, he's won. But, you know, it's like, it's kind of a trick, you know. The real trick is, well, now they let you go. Now what happens? Have you actually learned something? Can you really be different? And, you know, if you even have the slightest notion that maybe something was wrong, maybe I've been living my life wrong, that's a major victory. You're still going to be overwhelmed by that life. And that's where I'm coming from, which is not, you know, not far away from what you're saying about using the metaphor and using it, though in an extended sense, though, you know, it's probably true with your book, too.
Do you want to comment on this?
Marcel, I'd like you to reorient me.
Okay, yeah. No, I was just wondering, I mean, the sense of, well, in a work like Numbers, where there's such the repetition compulsion, or in Rushes, where, you know, it's the sexual acts and the, you know, the being driven in that way, in the sense of it becomes a way of showing that you're alive. And I just wonder if you see that in relationship to the act of writing as well.
I would say that the two main factors in keeping me alive are writing, and for a long time bludgeoning any feelings with, you know, sex, which is what I documented in several of the books. As I've grown older, I began to look more deeply into what was at play, and now I actually begin to understand some of my books.
That's always good.
That's always good.
I can understand that in Numbers, Johnny Rio is really trying to thwart death with sex. And I think that basically Yes, that is probably the time when our awareness of death and finality is kept at bay, as it were. And then I suppose that's the reason that very, very often orgasm results in a kind of isolated feeling, that sort of thing.
And is writing the same thing then?
I'm not sure that. I feel very alive when I'm writing, and that was when I felt most alive. Since we're talking about sex, I've never been aroused by any sexual passage that I've written myself.
You've never been aroused by any sexual passage that you've written yourself?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, never.
But then again, you always say that whenever you're bored in a movie, that's when you get an erection.
Oh, yeah. If I'm very, very bored, there was one movie.
The puns just keep on continuing. You know?
Yeah.
I get bored in a movie.
There was one particular movie that I don't think anybody has ever seen. I hope nobody will ever see again. And that's a movie called Julie and Celine Go Bowling. Celine and Julie Go Bowling. And it's about 4 hours of nothing. And I had a hard-on because I had to stay. A ferocious hard-on because of the...
Because you thought you were going to die?
No. Yes, I thought I was going
and
to
you
die.
You said, I got to live.
I had to...
I need an erection. And I hold on to this.
I had to survive.
And I'll survive.
I couldn't leave because I was with certain people who would have been outraged. There was, however, just to recapture that event, there was a gentleman who actually died during the showing of that movie.
In the theater or somewhere in LA?
In the theater. He was sitting in the front, in the back row, and had a heart attack and fell back.
That's because he didn't have an erection. If he had one, he would have been alive.
He might have. But anyhow, boredom really does. I have no reason. Arouse me. So what?
I hope you're not bored. Anybody bored out there?
All right. Well, you know, the passage that you read, John, I wondered how you both see the interplay between heterosexual sex and homosexual sex.
Great.
In the works that you're writing. I mean, John read a passage that was, you know, humorous, and very frequently the heterosexual sex passages are humorous, sometimes moving.
Yeah.
And Walter, in your, you know, in other scenes in particular, the sex that you describe is heavily, frequently anal, frequently involving conquest, control, you know, characteristics frequently associated with gay sex. So I wondered if you could talk about...
Is that true?
Yes.
There's like no control in heterosexual sex?
No.
My God. I've been in another world. Guys, like in heterosexual sex, don't think about control. I mean, one of the reasons I was thinking if I could write a book is like to actually think of a guy who doesn't, you know, because I think it's unusual.
Well, maybe Ed Hart, and maybe it's really about him and Johnny Fry, you know. I mean, your book. What I just wondered is how you see the interplay between the gay and the heterosexual sex in the events that you're describing.
You know, at some point or another, sex is sex, right?
No.
At some point or another, sex is sex.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And I'm all for differences. And I'm all for saying, you know, we are different,
like,
and thank God.
The experience, there's certain experiences of sexuality, the experience of, you know, a passion, of arousal, of orgasm, like, I mean, there's all these other things, you know, and that there's a lot of issues about submission, there's things about fighting, because there's that big fight and the cockfight in the book. And so I was kind of wondering how my character kind of went through. So, like, when he goes, for instance, when he's in the sex club, and there are the two men who are just sitting there passionately kissing, and he says, I got to get out of here, and the woman asks him, well, you just don't want to see these men kissing, and he says, no, there's just too much feeling, I can't take it, you know, and he moves on. You know, this is like, you know, part of his learning about his own sexuality, you know, and maybe not learning about it. I mean, I'm not sure how much, you know, I'm not sure how much Cordell learns in this book. I'm not trying to answer the question. You're answering the question in a large term, like, can I answer, you know, like, how is this in the world? I don't know.
No, I'm asking yeah. it, how you see but it in your own book.
But as far as he's concerned, I think that, you know, he's like, wow, there's this whole world that I don't know anything about. And there's no way for him not to be obsessed by it.
John?
Although I'm associated with writing about gay sex, I've actually written more books that are not centrally about gay sex, but are about heterosexuality. But once a writer is labeled one thing or another, you know, you try to break out of that that mold, which I constantly try to do. For example, Lyle Clemens does have gay sex in it. What I feel is that there are essential differences in the homosexual experience, both sexually and heterosexual experience, very basic ones. And in fact, I see now something happening in the gay world that I rue very much, which is what I see as kind of accepting heterosexuality as a norm, and which results in what I call heterosexual imitation. I think that there are basic differences. For example, I think that in the gay culture, the tendency toward dating is utterly reactionary. We never dated. No. We met. We didn't exchange names. We had.
That got a reaction.
That's my friend out there. I don't know why. I apologize.
Okay.
Okay.
We met. We never exchanged names. This was largely the culture. There were exceptions, of course. And then if there seemed compatibility, the arrangements were made, we'd go to one person's house or another or to an alley, a garage, whatever was more convenient, and we would have sex. And that was it.
And when you say that's it, what do you mean? I mean, like, there's nothing going on inside?
I would say not.
Okay.
Now, to me, again, in the gay context, love would be what would survive sex. If, for example, you went home with somebody and you stayed overnight, and then you as happened.
And that's love?
Yeah. Well, out of that, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a long affair. But then that a miraculous synapse could occur, as has occurred in my life with my partner of 25 years, Michael, has enriched my life. But we're talking now about the sexual, and the reason that I think that that to accept the sexual norm as heterosexual is interfering with gay relationships is because people now, you know, date, find out all kinds of things about each other that render sex impossible.
I like that very much. But you know, that could be broadened, I think.
It is very, very true, and because, you know,
and it's also true that when we're talking about, I just want to make sure that like all of our terms are here. So when you're talking about men now in gay sex. So we're leaving like half the world out of this.
Of course we are. Okay,
and
we are.
Where are they in that? In this?
Oh, I have no idea. I've never been a lesbian.
All right. Okay. Yeah. I just want to know.
I've never been a lesbian, so. But you know what? I have to add this. I think if I were a woman, I would be a lesbian. I would not be able to cope with.
But would you date? The thing is, if you were a woman, would you date? That's what I want to know.
No. But again, on that point, you know, I was really being serious, because of how, you know, homosexuals emerge are born into the hostile
But I want to get back to your, question is, so is this like, can we leave half the world out of your question?
No.
Yes, but you're leaving my
I'm not leaving it out. I was asking you about within your own novels, how you saw the interplay.
Oh, okay.
We could look more broadly at the culture. I mean, for example, the idea of Sex in the City, where so many have argued that
and that's
Samantha's really a gay male, in drag, in a sense, I really disagree with. Because, I mean, what that implies is that women can't be promiscuous. Women can pursue sexual desire. Why not? I mean, why should it be so essentialist that either all sexuality is about domination, or that
not all? I just said it happens.
Okay.
I just said it happens. You know, it's like that's. I mean, it was an interesting notion. Yeah, I think that a lot of the terms of I think there is on the other side of what you were saying is that there is like a kind of tamped down, tied down notion of sexuality for like heterosexuals in America. So I'm writing when Cordell is sitting there and a woman he's hurt his hand very badly, and a woman realizes that his hand is hurt, and she's holding his hand at first, and then she starts squeezing his hand, and it's hurting him a lot, but he can't pull away from it, and it's like a very sensual moment, and she just holds it, and she tells him, all you have to do is move your hand. I'll let you go. And he can't do it. She has to let him go. And that's like this is like one of my scenes. I said, God, this is I like this scene very much. I feel that. And I think that as you may know, there are a lot of people who haven't liked this book, and I get all these really bad reviews. There's no plot. There's no character.
If you had written about it, see, there's a very basic difference about how, erotic literature written by a heterosexual is viewed, and erotic literature written by a gay man is viewed. And I can give you some examples. I wrote a book called The Coming of the Night, which is one of my best books. It just takes place one day of sex after sex after sex. A day that I imagine that's when AIDS came into Los Angeles. Okay, it's one of my best. It's really one of my best books. The whole imagery, again, metaphor. The whole imagery is one of contagion, but the word AIDS is never mentioned. I was looking at the gay world at the time and thinking that the promiscuity was pushing us into a dead end, as it were, where we were no longer being able to feel any emotion for each other. My relationship with Michael freed me, of course, from that. But the example that I want to give you is that a review of that book was scheduled for the August New York Times book review. Mm-hmm. I got the front page in the Los Angeles Times. Okay, and it did not appear. And my publishers kept contacting this gentleman, Chip McGrath, and they'd say, well, it's pending. Nothing ever appeared. It's been assigned, nothing ever appeared. So I believe in writing people, protesting. I write a lot of letters of protest very, very much. And so I wrote Mr. Chip McGrath, the editor, and asked him why this book was not being reviewed. I was working out at home, and the phone rang. It was an odd time, and then the voice said, "This is Chip McGrath." I can't imagine an adult calling himself Chip. So,
oh come on!
No, I really can't.
I've agreed with everything up till that.
Okay, all right. So I thought it was probably one of my students. Chip Studs,
Chip McCann.
Bud. Yeah, and then he said, "This is Chip McGrath." I said, "Oh." And he said, I'm editor of the New York Times Book Review, and I'm answering that why we are not reviewing your book.
You mean to say he's not writing it?
Yeah.
Yeah, me? Okay. I mean to say he's not writing it, but go on.
Yeah, he said, because a reviewer could not find a single page in your book to quote from, which is utter bullshit. I mean, my God, nothing. That has some of my best writing and non-erotic writing in it. So this was just, what I'm saying is that, the difference. It was the gay subject that had stressed him so. And he said, but in deference to you, I will look at the book myself and decide whether we will review it or not. No review appeared at all. So I wrote Mr. McGrath again. And I told him that finally reviews and reviewers don't matter, that they're remembered, if at all, as footnotes.
And really, not even that. But
yeah, yeah, that at all. And then, just to turn it into a triumphant story, when a biography was being written about me called Outlaw, they were referring to that incident, and I begged them to please put Mr. McGrath's name in a footnote.
Nice. I like that.
And it is. Sorry. And it is. And it is. And it is. So that was not enough. I then wrote Mr. McGrath and told him that my prediction had come true. I didn't tell him where.
But you pushed it so a little. He would, you know, yeah. Kind of fudged it.
Yeah. And then my letter ended superbly by saying, goodbye, Mr. Chip.
No more, no more letters after that. No more letters after that.
No, that we ended our correspondence.
Well, you know, it is true. Like, you know, it's like it might be that I'm only feeling a bit of the kind of prudishness in reviews that, you know, like I'm not, like, you know, I actually like the bad reviews that I've been getting. And you know, because it's just so much fun, you know, because, you know, because obviously they were really upset that, you know, about anybody writing about sex, period, you know, and I'm sure they'd be more upset about somebody writing about gay sex than somebody writing about heterosexual sex, but it doesn't mean that they're not upset about the heterosexual sex, or, you know, but there's, you know, there's a lot of sex that can be seen as gay sex in my book at any rate, you know, there are men having sex, so that's gay sex, but that's not what bothers them. What bothers them, you know, is the idea of saying, well, what you're talking about in the beginning, this is a metaphor. Just to say that there's a literary device at work in this. If it can be dismissed as pornography, which is one of the reasons I have trouble with the word pornography, because it's a word that people use to dismiss work with. But if you're writing work, you know, I mean, you know, Samuel Delaney wrote Hog, right? Hog is, man, you read Hog, it's really something. My book is just like Nancy Drew compared to Hog. You know, when he's
Hog?
Like, yeah, Hog, H-O-G-G. Yeah. Samuel Delaney, you know Chip? Oh, they call him Chip. Samuel Delaney. And, you know, it's like a real serious book. Like, you know, like everything from, you know, using snot as a lubricant when you're having sex with a 5-year-old girl. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But, you know, but it's all metaphor. It's all metaphor. It's all Proustian. Matter of fact, it has like 20-page arcs where at the end of it you realize, oh, God, that's what he's talking about. But, of course, when you're getting through it, it's kind of hard. But at the end of it, you go, my God, this guy's like a genius. But you're not going to have that because you have a system of people who say, my own sexuality, using Catholicism, I have to put it somewhere. I have to make it an image. I have to put a you know, you ever watch that commercial on television? They have like a champagne bottle. And the cork tops off, and then all the foam comes out and it comes down the side. And it's just a 15-minute commercial. And you go, wow. Like, and people are mad about my book. Look at this commercial. But that's where you have to put sex. You have to put it in a place where not only is it a metaphor, it's you know, it's somebody can deny it. It's the ability to deny. And if you write a book that nobody can deny, then they can't talk about it.
But I wonder if it's not because of the sexistential nature, I mean, that dimension of it being serious, rather than necessarily the metaphorical. I mean, I think of, for example, Marisa Holder's book, Give Sorrow Words. I don't know if you knew that book.
I know.
From the early 80s. And it was about somebody who was obsessed with having sex with Mexicans, and it was combined with a kind of bulimia, and it's a brilliant book. She ended up getting killed.
No Dominicans?
Oh, in Mexico.
In Mexico. She ended up getting killed in Mexico. You know, Kate Millett wrote the introduction to it. It is really an extraordinarily brilliant work.
Right. I remember.
And, you know, that represents the other half, too. I mean, in the sense of the woman and the female sexuality. Uh-huh. I think that this is possible to have this attitude towards sexuality, whether it's gay, whether it's straight, or whether it's by a male or a female. But it's what's threatening about it is it taking it really seriously.
Taking the world really seriously through it. It's saying, exactly. The world you live in and this world are not separate. I mean, no, but that's what you're saying when you're talking about the crosses. The world you're living in and the world I live in are not separate worlds. And, you know, the world that, that this book is in is not a separate world. And I think it, people have a problem with it because they want to be separate. So, yeah, it was a champagne bottle, man. It was a champagne bottle. That's all it was.
Don't you think, though, Walter, that part of the reaction toward this, negative reaction toward this book, is that you have not been associated
with overtly
sexual, though sexual, yes, but not overtly sexual subjects.
Well, no, yeah, you're like, right.
And people yeah. then and tend to...
Because people say that you're the gay writer. People say that I'm the mystery writer.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And, no matter what
and,
I say.
And there's a sense of betrayal. Like when I, yeah. write, when yeah, I write a non-gay absolutely. Book, yeah. as it true. Were, then, you know, my gay audience does not quite respond. Yeah.
And do you find that reviewers like who come to your book at that time will say, this is a bad book, it's not working? It's...
No, but I cherish that an English reviewer once said that I wrote the best heterosexual scenes of any writer.
Well, that was nice.
Humorous frequently.
Yes, Mandy Lang Jones.
I want to ask one last question that relates to this, these kinds of issues, and then we'll turn it open to you to ask your question. And that is that both of you, it seems to me, have really definitely avoided being ghettoized as in African-American literature or Latino literature and really have addressed a mainstream audience, partly through the choice of the genres that you've, you know, written in. But at the same time, you know, that the sexuality that you describe in your books have been racialized to some degree. I mean, maybe challenging, reversing stereotypes. But I wondered if you could talk about how you see the issue of race in your writings about sexuality. Because certainly with Johnny Frye, I mean, this is a very big dimension, the black-white issue,
you know,
isn't it?
I mean, the one thing... I think I don't know about you, John, but I mean I've tried to avoid being ghettoized, though I don't know if I've succeeded.
You're what?
You know, I've tried to avoid being ghettoized.
Oh, so have I.
But I'm not sure I've succeeded. I remember Octavia Butler kept on trying to say I'm not a science fiction writer, but it didn't work, you know. The thing is, I write about black male heroes. If I have a genre, it's about black male heroes. All my books are about black male heroes. And it's a wonderful thing, you know, because there are all these things, all these, like, places in the world that black men haven't been in literature, you know? So to write a book, you know, like, you know, with a black male hero and his sexual kind of, you know, awakening or awareness or semi-awakening or whatever it is, well, you know, it's not common. A black detective. When I published Devil in a Blue Dress... people were kind of excited about it when I was sending it out, and you know, most people wanted to see it. They said, "Wow, that's interesting—a black detective." And one publisher honestly said, "He said, but you know, there already is a black detective."
Oh.
And I said, "Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of white detectives." And he said, "I don't see what you mean." Honestly, I mean, you know, and so, you know, so, but in, you know, any book, like, you know, if you write science fiction, you know, I mean, anybody who watches Star Wars, everybody had, you know, the first Star Wars, everybody had, like, you know, not even blue eyes, but gray eyes and blonde hair, and there were no black people except for Darth Vader, and he didn't get a, you know, he didn't get a mention. But one of the wonderful things is I can go almost anywhere and talk about that. Sexuality is just, like, you know, one of the many places to go where that we haven't been, or we haven't been much. I won't say not at all, but we haven't been much because, you know, of a system, you know, of holding people down, holding people back, saying these people can't be these characters. I think that's one of the great things about literature. You can actually talk about worlds that people suspect, but they don't really know about.
Yeah, that's great. John, you want to say anything about this?
No, that's
okay.
That's good.
Then let's turn it open to you, your questions.
Margaret has a microphone, so you can't talk until the microphone gets to you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I got to say that I'd never really thought of either of you guys as being writers of erotic fiction until tonight and coming to hear you speak. But I have thought of you both as being writers of Los Angeles and bringing so much culture and history and knowledge of Los Angeles to your work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about Los Angeles and how it figures in your work and how it informs your work, and also how each other's, if you know each other's work, I'm just curious as to what you find in each other's work that sort of fleshes out your idea of Los Angeles.
John. Okay, I really don't know how to answer specifically. All I can tell you is that, yes, I feel that Los Angeles has influenced me profoundly. And I'm a champion of this city. I write letters when it's put down, like recently Kathleen Turner saying she'd never seen exceptional theater in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you can look up my rebuttal in the Los Angeles Times Sunday where I called her fatuous. Okay, but
that means she's overweight.
No. that doesn't matter. But I do love Los Angeles. I think that it too has suffered from being stereotyped. I see the mythology of Los Angeles as being extremely rich. The cliches are the source of richness in Los Angeles. That's what I've explored. The attention to physicality, the lushness, the promiscuous religions, all that. I think, yeah, that does exist, but they're not awful. They're terrific. And in my work, Los Angeles is a main character very often, especially in Bodies and Souls. Walter?
I think of Los Angeles as like a slow motion explosion. Right, John, what do you have? Like in 1945, you have like maybe 200,000 people here, so maybe 300,000, something like that. And so like every year since 1945, there's another 100,000 people. You know, that's like astonishing. There's no city like that in this country. There are very few cities like that in the world. And explosions, they don't make any sense, really. You know, I mean, they do kind of finally at the end, you know, of time. And I love watching, you know, the Black Los Angeles. Everybody says, you know, the important streets are Hollywood, Vine, Sunset, but really the important street is Central, right? Important street is where the music came, where the music grew, where music, you know, thrived. You know, the important thing was that, you know, African-Americans and also Chicanos are like immigrants. In a very important way, coming here after 1945, and how people felt about themselves and how they transformed the city, and how a city couldn't really, a city that, you know, like every other city in America, wants to be racist, you know, wants to be exclusionist, couldn't be because it was growing too fast. The explosion was happening too fast. You know, white guy says, hey, man, I'm not going to work next to them niggers. And the white guy said, listen, man, the niggers want to work. Shit, you know. I'm going to put them to work, and you're going to work right next to them, I'm going to fire your ass, you know? So white guy said, well, I guess I got to work with the niggers. And then after a while, he's saying, well, you know, the niggers aren't that bad. You know, they're okay. As a matter of fact, they're Negroes. You know, it's a very interesting notion, you know? And you don't have it. You can't have it in, you can't have it in New York. You can't have it in Alabama. You can't. There are places that can't happen because they're not growing. They're not changing like that. But this is a city that's kind of like a living explosion. And the explosion, sometimes it's wonderful. Sometimes it's terrible. But you just kind of follow it out, you know, in any book.
But we don't have bed bugs.
He has this thing about bed bugs in New York. You know, he once lived in New York, and I think he lived in a bad neighborhood. His room was $8 a night. I remember this. There's something about
$8
bed bugs.
$8
a week. A week. A dollar a night, man. Two on Sunday.
Back there.
A lot of what I've heard described tonight is your character's sexuality and their need for sex. But I also want to know, when you're a writer, how you use Eros and the need for Eros in that character to truly make it erotica. I am just tired of a lot of 80s and 90s novels, and now going into 2000, where I'm turning back to the turn of the century to understand Eros and the need for sexual expression through Eros and not just through the need of sex. And I'd like you to if you can, define for yourself what is eros and what is sex.
Walter?
What, John? Oh. Well, you know, when you start, I know it's been a long time since I've been in a room where Freudian phrases keep getting thrown around. You know, it's like the compulsion to repeat, you know, and which I just love, the compulsion to repeat. It's like one of the, my great things.
But that's very boring.
Yeah. How boring is it? Talk about Thanatos and Eros, right? To talk about, I mean, you know, I think John was talking about death and that striving to survive, which is Eros, I think, you know, in the face of death. As a matter of fact, I don't think Eros can exist outside of the face of death, you know, of losing, but of your life, you know, or losing life, or not having life. And then that works into the metaphor of it, that to say, you know, I'm my life has no meaning. You know, and especially you get, because yeah, I kind of like existentialism, like on a parallel with the midlife crisis, you know, where, so I have a character, he's about, you know, he's 45 years old or something like that. He's having a midlife crisis, but it's existential in its base. And one of the things is that there's no meaning in his life. And that is death. It's a form of death. And you will die if you don't do something about that. And you know, now, I'll say that. I'm going to say that because I can say all that safely and feel that it was something I was really trying to do in this book, and it was something I was thinking about, whether or not I succeeded in it. But, you know, I have to say that I feel, you know, one of the interesting things about being a writer, I don't know if John agrees, though I think he might from something he said earlier, writing is a very unconscious activity. And a lot of what you say in the book, in the fiction, maybe even in the letters, is something that you may not be aware of. So I've taken on the life of a man seeking succor in some way, but also meaning through sexuality. I'm absolutely sure that he encounters the force of Eros in it, but I don't think I could explain it. You're not gonna say nothing, huh, Jim?
No, that's good.
You know that thing with the thing when you were saying that you learn later what your book meant.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I really identify with that because, you know, sometimes you look back and say, hey, wow, that's what I was saying. Damn, I was smart.
That's appealing. Yeah, that does recur.
Yeah.
I have a question about the conscious and the unconscious. I was interested, Walter, in reading your book. I was kept waiting for the direct confrontation between Cordell and Joelle about the betrayal. And it never, he keeps walking up to the line, mm-hmm. and then he walks away. And he walks up to the line, and he walks away. I thought that was really interesting, and I wondered if that was intentional or how you came about that, whether to do a direct confrontation or not.
Yeah, you know, he's so afraid in the story about who he is. He's so unsure of his manhood in some ways, but also just his weight in the world, his like literal weight in the world, that he's afraid to confront her. At one point early in the book, he comes and he's going to confront her. I'm just telling the audience that, because I know you know this, but he comes to confront her and... But the minute he sees her, he wants to have sex with her. And so they start having sex, and then he realizes that she's putting him in all the positions that she was in with Johnny Fry. So he's kind of, in a way, cuckolding himself. That, I think, is an image of what his life is like. It's like with her, but it's like everywhere. He is like, you know, going through the motions, but the motions aren't kind of new or interesting or even meaningful for him. Even if they are new for him and not new for her, you know. She's saying, well, yeah, this is what he did, so you can do it. But she doesn't say that. She never says anything either. And I think that we have a lot of secrets in sexuality, and there's a lot of abuse in it. And that's kind of what I wanted to leave it at. You don't really need answers, you know. I shot you in the head. Who shot me? Damn, I'm shot in the head, man.
Okay. Right there.
In the passages that both of you read, humor was entwined with the sexuality. And I'm going to slide over to a different medium, and it made me remember a film that I saw with a girlfriend when we were in college, that when we came out, we went for coffee together, and she was, like, very, very frustrated. And she went, like, what was that supposed to be about? Was that supposed to be, like, political, or was it supposed to be sexy, or was it supposed to be funny? It was an Italian film. And I went, like, it was supposed to be all of those. It was supposed to be all of those things. Like, why should it bother you? And she was an intelligent person. But she went, like, no, I expect it to be, like, one or the other. Something cannot be sexy and funny and political. Do either of you... because you feature humor with sex, do either of you ever get those questions from your readers who think that something has to be one or the other?
Walter.
No. Can't do that again. No.
I really don't understand the question.
Well, Pedro Almodovar is a perfect example, because there are some scenes in Almodovar's movies where they are hilarious, they are incredibly erotic, and then they're incredibly threatening, all simultaneously. And it's that ability to handle the tone, the ability to move from one to the other and have them all working simultaneously, that really has been the uniqueness of his ability in the comic melodrama. I think John has a lot of that.
No, I really just wanted to hear Marcia talk about Almodovar. I know that she would. I thought that that would be
makes up for Celine and Julie Capote.
So I thought that that was apt. But I absolutely agree with you that a book can be many things: satire, very serious. All my books have a lot of humor, a lot of sex, and a lot of sorrow too. I would say that one of the main themes in my writing is aging, the horror of aging, and therefore the horror of death. And that is, that coexists.
Which is the birth of Eros.
Below the others. Pardon me?
Which is the birth of Eros.
Yeah.
I find that most people, when people get upset about things like that, it's because they've been bothered by something, and they use it as a way to get out of it. People start criticizing, because some things are perfectly, perfectly wonderful. It's funny, it's serious, at the end somebody dies, Something Wild is kind of a wonderful film. It starts off, everybody's really funny, and all of a sudden it turns really serious. You go, oh my God. I almost turned off the movie at that point. But I still really enjoyed it. But I think that some people get, a book, a really, really good poetry can touch you in a way that, that makes you rebel against it, and that certainly happens to me. And people, say, "I don't want to hear about that. I just don't want to hear it. So shut up. You're stupid."
I realized just now that every one of my books ends up rather sadly.
Oh, no. I think that's a perfect ending. We're not going to get better than that.
I enjoyed it so much. Yes.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.